Actually, I'm jealous of all the armored people because, preparing this talk, and I thought it would be really nice if I could just fire up someone else's transparencies. But so, do event horizons play a critical role in gamma ray bursts? Oh, there's a question mark. Now, what role? Well, the role is easy to describe. It's maintaining baryon purity, which is, as well now well understood, a crucial ingredient for getting cosmological gamma ray bursts. I'll explain that in somewhat more detail. If at cosmological distances, gamma ray bursts are highly super Eddington by any reasonable set of assumptions, and in coming out, the electromagnetic energy would have to drag out baryons along with them. The baryons would soak up the energy of the burst, and even if you wanted to recover them by shocking them at some larger radius, in order to fit the data, you would have to you would need a very large bulk Lorentz factor, and that requires, in any case, a very small amount of baryon contamination. So how much can you tolerate? Well, there have been all sorts of calculations.
That's a question. If I look at the Crab pulsar, that has a spin down power, and something's coming out of it, and it's almost 10 to the 39 arcs per second. It certainly manages to do that without barrier contamination. So it's not.
I don't know if it could put out 10 to the 51, though. what? 100 or 3? 10 to the 39. I mean, I'm actually going to, I'll have a transparency which I think will satisfy you. It's on the list of things I'm not going to talk about, but it's there. Well, there were various estimates and numerical computations, a whole long list actually. I'm going to give a brief analytic derivation due to Amir Levinson, who did it in the last few weeks. He was my student. Basically, the point is, if you know that the fireball, if you know that the baryonic flow passes through a critical point, then it's very easy to estimate the mass loss rate given the luminosity. And by critical point here, I don't mean quite the Parker critical point. It's the point at which gravity acting on the baryons is just balancing the outward pressure of the pairs and gamma rays whose pressure is pushing them out. Way down here, the baryons are very dense. I mean, gravity wins. But if the density baryons goes to zero by the mean value theorem, there always will be a point at which the outward pressure is exactly balancing gravity. And it's most convenient to calculate the mass loss rate just at that point.
David, a quick question. Why are you considering neutrinos?
Oh, I am considering. However, I think what the neutrinos do most effectively is heat.
But in
is heat the matter?
for classical GRBs, cosmological GRB particles,
yeah,
they're probably the dominant mechanism for driving mass loss.
By heating or by straight momentum? I mean, if you want to add neutrinos, if you want to add neutrinos to this, you can. That will only increase the mass loss rate. I mean, it will only increase. But basically, I'm assuming that what the neutrinos would, the contribution they would make that would be best appreciated is to convert their energy. How does it work? To convert their energy to momentum or something. But basically, to heat the matter. And
I'll wait until your phone.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. At the very least, there's this pressure. The temperature that establishes this this pressure in fireball is the temperature is established by the equilibrium between the neutrinos and the matter. But the neutrinos at this point are they just have a much lower cross section, so I'm not considering them directly. Anyway, basically, it's if you know the temperature here, or actually, if you know how the temperature scales with the radius, then it's easy to estimate the density, the critical density, and you know that at this point the velocity of the baryons is exactly equal to their own cell velocity. In other words, basically the thermal velocity of the baryons themselves, and the if you want to intuit what it feels like to pass through a critical point, just imagine yourself driving when there's road construction up ahead. I mean, that's the subsonic part. The characteristics reach you long before I actually see the impediment. But the minute you pass through, the minute that lane opens up again, I mean, you just feel this surge of relief, you know, because you're no longer getting these characteristics coming at you from downstream. And now the point is, if you wanted to predict the flux of cars on 101, you couldn't, because it could be anything. But if you knew there was road construction, then you could predict it exactly, because you know the density of cars just, you know, just behind the impediment is bumper to bumper, and the traffic has a very definite sound velocity given by it's the length of a car times the reaction time of the driver. So you know exactly what the M dot is at this point, and you know the cars at this point are moving exactly at the sound velocity, because right here there's a rarefaction wave propagating upstream relative to the fluid. So to figure out the all you need to know is the temperature here, which you figure out by the equilibrium between neutrino matter interactions, and basically you just get all these heating and cooling rates from the literature, and you find out that it ends up being about 10 to the 10th degrees, which you pretty much knew. And that immediately gives you an M dot, which is, and in principle, this should work for supernova too, to give you at least a minimum estimate of mass and energy ejection. Anyway, it comes out to be a lot. It comes out to be, I would say, of order a hundredth of a solar mass. And the N dot scales is the luminosity, the neutrino luminosity, that is, to the 9/8 power, which is almost linear. I mean, it's not going to help by being gentle or by releasing it more gradually. N-bion integrated over time is just L integrated over time, almost in linear proportion. And that tells you how much mass is blown off.
Can you cover what you mean by mass in this estimate, sorry?
Baryons.
This is the baryon mass.
Yeah. That's blown off by neutrinos, essentially.
You're very mysterious.
Yeah. But the mass here is enough that the gamma that you estimate would be at most moderate.
I mean, I recall the Dunning experiment where Wasserman found a stronger dependence of M dot on L nu. Why do you get a different, weaker scaling?
I have no idea. I read that, I looked at their paper, 125 equations in it. They pick their solutions by matching all sorts of boundary conditions in infinity. I honestly didn't follow all the details of their paper, but this argument is so simple that I just don't see what's wrong with it.
If I had a magnetic field,
I could
hold
it. If you had a magnetic field, you would redo the problem, including. There are many ways to carve a critical point. You know, it depends what you put on the left-hand side of the equation, what you put on the right-hand side of the equation. But I think you could do the same analysis if you had a magnetic field in there. I've never actually forced myself to sit down and do it. Okay. Anyway, that's just to introduce you to the problem. Now, there are many possible solutions. There have been at least suggested solutions. One is that the star is strange, so that the baryons are held in really tightly by non-gravitational forces, to say the least. And strange matter is even at zero pressure, essentially at nuclear density. So it's at that density all the way up to the surface of the neutron star, and the nuclear forces, if you want to call them that, the QCD forces are operative at Fermi length scales all the way up to the surface. I don't know. I mean, Vladimir Usov is carrying the banner here. I mean, would like to argue that a lot of neutron stars show evidence of being strange, in which case they wouldn't really be neutron stars. They'd be strange stars. But I have to say, in the past month, I've been very impressed by the standard model of neutron stars. I mean, it's looking pretty good in all sorts of ways. A very clever suggestion was made by Kuzniak just after the reports of neutrino oscillations in the atmosphere. If you scale those parameters down to several MeV and the oscillations with the sterile type, he argued that the neutrinos could just get out of the star as sterile neutrinos without influencing the matter at all, and then oscillate back just 10 kilometers above. When they're safely ahead of the matter and do their business there. And now there's you could also argue, as if I were Mal Rudiman, this is what I would argue, You just charge up a magnetosphere with a current in it, and the matter is safely settled down into the star by gravity, and then very quickly annihilate the field up above the matter in the magnetosphere, and then it's simply ahead of the matter. I mean, it illuminates the surface and excites a wind, but it doesn't excite nearly as much as if the energy had come from below. So basically, if you want to store 10 of the 52 ergs into magnetic field, be my guest, that ought to produce a hell of a burst.
If it's rapidly spinning, like a molly check, you don't have to put that much energy into at any one moment.
Well, if it's, if you're relying on, if you're getting out rotational energy, then that rotational energy is in the matter, and then you have to do the calculation, you know, where the fast alpha, where the fast negasonic critical point is, and so forth. But if it's sort of like what Chris Thompson proposes for soft gamma ray bursts, then you just, it's all happening above the matter. It's just the magnetic field floated up above and just purified itself that way. Now, another proposal which actually hasn't really been suggested, and for good reason, but the reason I bring it up is because it might produce a different type of gamma ray burst that has not yet been discovered. Basically, if all the matter falls quietly into a black hole and there's a strong magnetic field, the black hole could basically eject sort of this blob of pure magnetic field, which would float out as low frequency electromagnetic radiation, except that the electric fields then might be strong enough to produce all sorts of all the exotic pair creation that we see in pulsars and the like. But no matter would get out. And I think the entire duration of such an event would be of the order 10 to the minus 5 seconds. And for those 10 to the minus 5 seconds, luminosity might be very high, and maybe one day we'll see something like that. But I don't think they explain the classical gamma ray bursts that we think about now. So now I think that, yeah, one of the most conservative but almost the party line at this point, it's simply that there's an accretion disk around the black hole, and the gamma ray burst is in fact a jet that's emitted along magnetic field lines that thread the event horizon. Clearly, baryons can't get out along those field lines, and they're magnetically insulated from coming there by way of the accretion disk. On the other hand, you need an accretion disk feeding the black hole just to feed the event, to energize the event. So there has to be matter outside the accretion disk over most of the duration. Sorry, there has to be matter outside the event horizon over most of the duration of the gamma ray burst. how do you get the energy? How do you get energy onto horizon threading field lines without getting baryons? You can either use the Blanford's Nyack mechanism if the field's strong enough, or you can use nu-bar annihilation. The neutrinos cut across field lines very easily. So I don't think that's too much of a problem. I think that you have a problem getting 10 to the 53 ergs onto horizon threading field lines from the accretion disk, but I don't think that 10 to the 50 is a big problem. So the picture is simply that you have a pure baryon poor jet, or baryon pure jet flowing out along field lines that connected to the event horizon. But by the same arguments that I just gave, the accretion disk, which is releasing all this energy just as an entrance card to get even near the black hole, has to be emitting a baryonic wind together with the fireball. I don't see any way of getting around this. And the main prediction of this model, therefore, is that gamma ray bursts include an unseen baryonic wind that enshrouds the fireball. Well, the question naturally arises then, how could we hope to see the baryonic wind? By definition, it's not permitting gamma rays to escape efficiently. Kuczynski has suggested that you look for optical emission from the radioactivity in it. And in fact, he's proposed that mysterious short-lived optical transients might be just that. But it doesn't prove that it's part of the gamma ray burst event, because you would have to see them coincident with gamma ray bursts, and that has not been seen yet. It's also possible that our processed material that is actually made in neutron-rich matter that's ejected from events like this. But again, that in itself wouldn't prove any connection with the gamma ray burst fireballs necessarily. They could be separate things. Similarly, if say a gamma ray burst originated in a neutron star magnetosphere, it might be possible to have a pure fireball without having any baryons at all. In other words, if the neutron star succeeded in containing all its baryons, by lattice forces or simply because the energy release happened above the surface, that would be fine. Then you would not get any, you wouldn't necessarily get any baryonic wind, and the fireball might be emitted in almost all directions. So the question arises then, can you find any observational consequences of the coincidence between the fireball and the baryonic wind? They're being both together at the same place at the same time with a huge contrast in their qualitative contrast in their parameters. Well, one thing you might hope to see is a lot of gamma ray bursts where you just saw the reflected gamma rays, the scattered gamma rays off the corridor of the baryonic outflow. So imagine the gamma ray burst is directed with high gamma and very strong beaming downward. Any observer straight down would see a gamma ray burst. But now consider an observer off to the side. He doesn't see the central engine, but he may manage to see gamma rays that are scattering off baryons.
So this model requires an opening angle that's comparable to 1 over gamma. So rather narrow.
Well, I'm going to get to the opening angle again, because when there's baryons here, it may affect it. I mean, it may actually even be smaller than 1 over gamma. But for what I'm about to talk about, I don't require a small gamma. I may require it for other reasons, but I don't require a small opening angle. I will eventually require it. But you know, there may be some gamma ray bursts where the opening angle is fairly large. I don't know.
That's a tremendous amount of pressure. Gamma rays pushing anionic outflow.
That's right. You have to equate, if you want to make a model of a hydrodynamic model of this, you have to equate the pressures at this interface. I'll get to that. now, first of all, this observer would see only a very small fraction of the total gamma rays. We calculated that, and I'll show you the result. You would also see a relatively soft spectrum, because any, generally speaking, gamma rays above an MeV or so would be strongly softened by Compton recoil as they scattered. And so gamma rays well above an MeV, I think, would be filtered out in the scattering process. And finally, he would see, you know, gamma ray bursts generally tend to be very spiky. You know, you get a lot of spikes within, certainly within a typical long burst. You get a lot of peaks. But here, in general, the scattering would tend to, and this is a generalization, of course, but I think a fairly robust one, but seeing contributions from various scattering points would smear out the light curve, so you see a very smooth light curve. Now, gamma ray bursts 980425 had all these properties, and that's the gamma ray burst which was coincident with supernova 1998 BW. If the association is real, then the intrinsic luminosity of this gamma ray, what we saw was a very small fraction of what you usually see from a gamma ray burst, because it was so close. Had it been at cosmological distances, we would have never seen it. The interpretation is it happened to be nearby. The supernova itself had by far the largest ejection velocity I've ever heard about. I mean, it was 50 or 60,000 kilometers per second, which is a factor of 5 at least over the typical supernova type 1b or 1c's. And it had an unusually high level of radioactive elements in it. I haven't actually seen that paper. I've heard it by way of rumor, though. And how much mass could it have ejected if it has 10 to the 51 ergs and going at C over 6? I wouldn't think much more than, say, a tenth of the solar mass or so. And I haven't had a chance to think about it, and I want to make this suggestion strictly off the record. But what we're seeing here does not look very much different from what I would expect an exposed neutron star wind to look like. The mass and ejection velocities and the composition seem very similar to the calculation of Amir Levzin. Now, there may be helium or something in here, but certainly the amount of enveloped material that loaded this down must have been very small, and it really smacks of something that's driven straight off a neutron star. Just a suggestion. So that may simply be a case in which we saw gamma rays reflecting off the corridor established by the surrounding baryonic wind that accompanied the fireball. We actually did some detailed calculations on the V over V max that you would expect to get from that geometry, given the decrease in luminosity, and given and just given the amount of surface that's exposed along your line of sight. Now, this is as a function of viewing angle from the axis of the object itself. And typically, you know, you only expect that one, even if most bursts were like this, you would only expect to see a very small fraction of them, because you could only see the ones that were nearby. On the other hand, you know, if you see 10 to the minus 4 here, don't take that too seriously yet, because you don't know what the opening angle yet is of a typical gamma ray burst. And you have to, this is per unit solid angle, and you actually have to scale the solid angles to get the bill of incidence. And that's still an uncertainty.
Go ahead.
What would the birth rate be of these objects? If you see one in, you know...
Well, that's... I'm going to get to that because so far I'm assuming that every gamma ray burst is like this. And the question then is, what do you have to assume about typical gamma ray bursts in order for you to see the what you see at the observed relative frequencies? In other words, the apparent frequencies of occurrence of the different types.
The bursts like this, which are as smooth as this burst line curve was, are already very rare in the catalog. But can you explain why this would represent 10% of the afterglows?
Of the what?
Afterglows. So.
Oh, that's. Well, first of all, this was not.
Maybe that's an unfair question. Nobody can. But
actually, this did have an afterglow. Yes.
Well, the afterglow was a supernova, right? But
sort of. I mean, if it was a supernova, I mean, there was X-ray. It may be now that there was X-ray afterglow. That keeps changing. I haven't gotten the most recent though. But there may be afterglow that's not consistent with a supernova. It's just a little bit uncertain. However, in general, you're right. Any one of these things that is rare is actually not so rare if you compare it to the other afterglows. And I'm going to get to that.
Oh.
Yeah. So I'll deal with this later. No. Okay, now I want to get to a different gamma ray burst that raises some of these same questions even though it's opposite in character. This one was, rather than being unusually dim, was unusually bright, it was unusually bright by any reasonable definition. Gamma ray is 990123, very famous, got a lot of media hype. It had an isotropic equivalent luminosity of more than a solar rest mass.
Luminosity or energy?
Energy. I meant the integral of this over 10. Came out to be about 3 times 10 to the 54 ergs. Had it been emitting from the galaxy, it was identified with isotropically. With all due respect to models that come up with this amount of energy, I tend to conclude that it's almost certainly implies collimation, and very good collimation at that.
Why?
What? Because I conclude that the amount of energy available to, I assume that the amount of energy available to make this burst was much less than 3 times 754 Earths. And that it, therefore, if the isotropic equivalent is many orders of magnitude greater than the actual luminosity, then that means it was highly colored.
The same argument was used to prove there were a lot of cosmological distances, I think. Or a similar argument.
Well, I would say it would be the opposite argument, because this was certainly identified with something at a very cosmological distance.
Yeah.
I think the red shift was something like 4?
3.4, I think, isn't it?
3.4.
Yeah.
But your delta omega could be 10 to the minus 1. In the way you
what?
Your delta omega could be 10 to the minus 1.
Well, your premise of it's limited by a stellar mass could also be wrong,
Okay.
Did this one have an afterglow?
What?
Did this one have an afterglow?
Yes, I think so.
Well, you wouldn't have a redshift measure.
Oh, it certainly had, it certainly had an optical
but
afterglow.
How much energy came out of the afterglow? The afterglow is going to be a lot more isotropic than the first and second.
I think that the energy in the X-ray afterglow was about 10 to the 52 in isotropic equivalent, and in the optical it was 10 to the 50 roughly in isotropic equivalent. So there was indeed much less, although part of that is because even if they had the same opening angle, it still would have been a lot less. Anyway, we wondered whether this baryonic outflow could have been what was collimating the baryon pure fireball. Now, I'm going to digress for a few minutes to just discuss the whole issue of collimation in general. I guess there are two schools of thought on the matter. One is that collimation happens because of a current that's carried by the material that makes a toward magnetic field that squeezes it. I guess I'm from the other school that says it's the interaction of outer parts of the flow with inner parts. It's basically the inertial forces between different components of the outflow. I think I'll just take 5 minutes to show a lot of pictures of flows that are seem to be collimated at large distances. Here it's the SS 433 jets where the precession cone is 20 degrees, but it looks like when it runs into the supernova run, it actually gets further collimated at distances I think almost a light year. In planetary nebula, it seems that there's a lot of collimation also on scales of about 10 to the 17th centimeters. And even when there's not collimation, they get very good fits to observe planetary nebula with purely hydrodynamic simulations. But some of them are well collimated, and you can explain that too simply with hydrodynamics. And I just have an excuse to show all sorts of nice pictures from HST. So here's a whole bunch of planetary nebula that show evidence for collimation at fairly large scale. By the way, these scales are large enough that even rotation could not possibly be playing a direct role.
Planarity can play a big role in the planetaries because the outflow velocity is so low that adding or subtracting the orbital velocity of the binary to the outflow velocity creates give your client a larger effect.
It could give you a large effect on the scale of the binary orbit.
It can give you a large effect on the shape of the outflow.
Could give you a large effect on the shape of the outflow, but it would tend to make the outflow equatorial, I would think. I mean, the additional velocity that you get from the binary orbit is invariably equatorial, I would think. I'm not quite sure.
Well, it actually changes, I believe it actually changes the entire shape. Because if the outflow velocity is here, only 20, 30 kilometers, 40 kilometers, or something, they're not very fast.
Well, some of these jets are much faster.
No. The planetaries are very slow. The inner winds from the planetaries are fast, but the most of the mass that comes off the planet comes with a very low velocity. It's just the escape velocity from some asymptotic giant mass. So wind from an asymptotic giant mass.
Yes. But, I mean, you're saying that stuff is out here? Or are you saying that it's here? I mean, granted, it is there, but I would think
that... There's gas that's ionized, which was once a molecular outflow from a star, a standing star.
Right.
Came up at a very low velocity, and later got photoionized, and also pushed around it by a denser wind. I mean, faster wind.
But I would think that all the binary effects would tend to flatten it along the equatorial plane.
I can get all sorts of shapes from it, and they're quite nice simulations by people who used to learn it. Be a little careful about. I think there's quite a lot of evidence in many of these that the shapes come from binary, just binary spots.
Or this.
Yeah. Or this.
Okay. Yeah. I just think that there's frequently evidence of good collimation, and that the collimation is taking place on the scales of these pictures. I could be wrong. I mean, the collimation here could have taken place way down in the middle. But I don't know. I don't even know where the rotation axis is there. Something like this.
Red rectangle.
What?
The red rectangle.
Sorry?
The red rectangle.
No, I don't think so. I was looking for that, and I think I left it upstairs. There's another. All right, now this one I like. I mean, this looks pretty axisymmetric. I think that this is the rotation axis, and this is, if there's a binary in there, it's in this plane. And I mean, you actually see things getting curved on scales of 10 to the 17 centimeters. I think this is the same thing. They show it with a blower. And here they actually give a little tutorial on a visual caricature of a spherical segments of a sphere or a barrel that are basically acting as a nozzle, collimating. But all the spheres, all the flows are presumably supersonic, and so that sort of nozzle is not a sonic point nozzle. It's just the inertial forces of the outer stuff on the inner stuff. And this guy is really well collimated. And here the velocity is huge. I mean, something was collimating it very well, and
is that a planetary?
It used to be thought to be a planetary, but I don't think it is anymore, because this outflow is clearly coming from something at least as compact as a white dwarf. I think it's, they gave the velocity in something like kilometers per hour, so I have trouble translating it, but it was really large. But the thing is, with hydrodynamic collimation, just an illustrative, a very simple illustrative analytic solution shows that spherical symmetry can be broken spontaneously. There's absolutely no rotation in here. Both the outer pressure and the inner wind are completely spherically symmetric, but a perfectly good solution is to get a perfect cylinder if the pressure happens to go as r to the minus 4. Nothing. It's a spontaneously broken symmetry. Just the ramp pressure at the interface from the inner wind always equals the pressure.
And the equilibrium
between
cylinders. What's your order?
Very very orientation cylinder.
Yeah. So I mean, presumably a slight bias established by the rotation axis sort of nudges it in this direction. But the point is, now the thing about the red rectangle, and I don't even remember if that's my favorite one, but there's actually one planetary nebula which the outer part looks extremely spherical, and the inner part looks like a cylinder, and it looks a lot like this. I mean, and I was going to draw a picture of it after not finding it in the gallery, but. And good point. So anyway, in planetary nebula, of course, it's non, everything's time dependent, but if you have a steady emission of winds from a complex source, say an inner jet coming from black hole and an outer baryonic wind coming from an accretion disk, you get the same type of collimation, but it would be in steady state. But basically, the inertial forces of the outer material collimating the inner material. If the luminosity here is greater than the inner luminosity, you can convince yourself that this inside material would shock and reheat, and then it would emerge as possibly as a conical section of a classical relativistically expanding fireball. The pressure in here would go as r to the minus 4. And that ends up being a really good pressure. It ends up being a really convenient radial dependence for pressure. When you numerically integrate the various the channel radius as a function of distance along the z-axis, you find that you tend to get straight lines asymptotically, depending on the luminosity ratio between the outer and inner components. Here's a similar result. Now, what happened to my... Anyway, it turns out that you can get a very simple analytic solution, which is exactly conical. Here, the pressure in the baryon pure jet is going as r to the minus 4, and it's, and the ramp pressure now is on the outside, but it's a trivial solution for the same reason that that cylinder inside, that basically cores out the inside of a sphere, is also a trivial solution. It's simply because the density in any ring goes as r to the minus 2, asymptotically, and the impact angle also goes as 1 over r, so the square of the impact angle goes as r to the minus 2. So the ramp pressure of a wing balancing a p to the minus 4, balancing an r to the minus 4 pressure will always be a straight line asymptotically. But here the opening angle depends on the ratio of luminosities. The larger the luminosity of the baryonic wind is compared to the baryon pure jet, the smaller the opening angle, which makes sense. The weaker the fireball is, the more easily it is to be collimated. The easier it is to collimate for a given baryonic wind. And when you use that analytic solution to to get the numerical factors, showing there's a factor of 2 over pi squared, but basically the isotropic equivalent of the baryon pure jet luminosity is actually inversely proportional to the actual luminosity of the fireball. So for a given strength of baryonic wind, the weaker you make the fireball, the stronger it will appear on those rare occasions when you happen to see it. So in this model, the reason that gamma ray burst 990123 appeared brighter than the rest of the universe combined was because it was unusually weak and therefore easy to collimate. And we have to conclude in this model that it had an extremely small opening angle. The luminosity of the energy in the fireball was only about 10 to the 50 ergs, and the energy coming off the baryonic wind was about 3 times 10 to the 52 ergs. Now, these numbers actually seem pretty reasonable. I could believe that you could get this much energy from an accretion disk that was working its way in. Because, you know, you release a solar mass, you drop a solar mass into a black hole, you should get at least 10 to the 53 ergs out in some form or another. And this is a reasonable amount to be made by Nunu-Bahr annihilation or even by Blanford's Nyack mechanism with I don't know, 10 to the 16th gauss fields or something. Something I used to think was preposterous, but no longer do. But there are implications for all this, which is that you have to say that the opening angle for 990123 was extremely small. And then you get to the question that Omer raised. If you just take the selection among afterglow bursts that were located with the help of afterglow, it's not all that pathological. It's not all that rare. On the other hand, you can make the quantitative prediction that all other things being equal, the opening angle, the probability of seeing a burst at a given distance should go as the apparent luminosity for the minus 2 power. Now this burst had an extremely, I should add parenthetically that in principle when we collect enough bursts, this is a quantitative prediction for the distribution of apparent luminosities or isotropic equivalent luminosities.
In gamma rays.
Yeah. But for the time being, we just have to say that the 990 and 23 was extremely pathological in terms of L apparent. It was, say, three orders of magnitude above the usual. By this formula, we should have only detected it, such a burst as one in a million. And yet, it was more like one out of 10, right? So what we have to say is that most bursts, most gamma ray bursts also have a very small opening angle. And therefore, most gamma ray bursts that happen in the universe go unseen by us because they're not directed at us. And therefore, we have to say the events are far more common than previously estimated, that we're only seeing this. Even if we say it's a 1/10 radian opening angle, that's 10 to the minus 2 over 4 pi, it's 1 in 1,000. So instead of needing one per galaxy every million years, you need one every 1,000 years. And it may even be worse than that. You may even need them once in 100 years.
I think on this model, the machine has done escape to infinity, so you're depositing a huge amount of energy, more than 10 to 53 Earths a second. Doesn't that leave scars that you should be picking up if it's once every 1,000 years in our galaxy?
Yeah.
But I'm depositing 10 to the 53 Earths, a small region.
Well, I assume you do that for every time you have a supernova.
No, most of that, 99% of that goes off neutrinos. It's not
right.
Positive. But your model has a neutrino-neutrino interaction.
Well, that's just giving like 10 to the 50th Earths. What you're getting is you're getting actually a lot out in the form of baryonic wind.
I thought most of your neutrinos.
No. The irony here is that most of the energy is in the unseen component. And that's the price you pay. The part that you see only looks bright, even though it's intrinsically weak. And therefore, you have to say you're only seeing a small fraction of it.
Can I come back to the afterglow?
Yeah.
The afterglow in this case would have to be connected with the baryonic wind. Because there's not enough energy in the beam to give you the afterglow.
That's a good point.
So you would have to conclude that the baryonic wind is somehow responsible for the afterglow. And once you can.
I might conclude that the afterglow is also very well collimated, although there may be models that say otherwise.
So you want to have a high gamma also?
I mean, after all, if you see.
You want to have a relativistic velocity gradient, a very high gamma core carrying little power. And then a lower gamma envelope carrying more power, I think.
I mean the current...
The afterglow also has gamma, then a very large gamma.
Is this in 0123?
I tend to associate the afterglow with the fireball, but I don't necessarily believe that that the fireball maintains exact conical geometry once it interacts with the interstellar medium in the galaxy. It's just okay. For just going back to SS-433, we see that the ambient environment collimates the cone at large distances. And if anything, the afterglow could even be more collimated than the primary burst.
The question is whether the radiation from the afterglow is collimated. It's not a question of whether It's not a question where the momentum is. Once it's not relativistic, presumably the radiation is pretty isotropic. And
once it slows down, yes.
Yeah, and so you have these measures of afterglow, which have much more energy than this in the gamma ray versus some well collimated.
Well, I mean, the X-ray afterglow is a lot more. Yeah, that's a lot more. And but can we really say for sure that the X-ray afterglow happened after the collimation was lost?
Well,
after the gamma was lost?
Very small. Very large still.
I mean, certainly. It would.
Beam it, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, you'd have to beam it.
Right. I mean, most of the energy in the X-ray afterglow was at early times.
Was at early times. And I would say that the gamma during the X-ray afterglow was still pretty large. It is a fair point, and I'm going to worry about it, but at least the X-ray afterglow...
I expect to see lots of afterglows. And the afterglow is likely to be much less relativistic than the gamma ray bursts.
That's true. If you saw afterglows without seeing gamma ray bursts, that would be just fine with me.
Yeah, lots of them.
It's sad, but I think the limits on that are much worse than you would hope for when you actually look at the X-ray.
They are now. They are now, but in the future they may not be.
Thrift is a thing.
I should add that to this list, you know, unaccompanied afterglows. I propose that. Therefore, that people consider various signs of gamma ray bursts when they're off the viewing axis. I mean, that may be one of them. X-ray lines and scattered X-rays may be another. Linear polarization. Some of these seem fairly futuristic, such as neutrinos from pickup X neutrons in the fireball. The neutrons that have drifted in and decayed in the fireball, we give you very high energy. We immediately become very high energy particles and give you lots of high energy phenomena. One thing that may not be entirely futuristic is beryllium axis. It's now estimated that you need about 4 × 10⁻⁷ beryllium nuclei produced in every supernova. At least on the average per supernova in the galaxy, and it's very hard to get from the supernova remnants. Even if you make cosmic rays in young supernova remnants, I mean, there really is some evidence now that the cosmic rays are made in the extremely dense environment of the supernova itself, and that's a fascinating possibility. The other thing is that if you isolated likely candidates for scattered gamma ray bursts, and they would have to be, have a much larger V over V max than the long hard ones. And such a tendency has already been reported by Chobani, although he did, I'd like to make a sharper prescription for what subset of bursts to take. He looked at long soft ones. I suggest if you look for long smooth soft ones, you would get a V over V max approaching point five, very close to 0.5. I could make a summarizing remarks, but I think you all could too, so why not just stop.
Two quick observational comments. One is the gamma ray burst, Chris or somebody may know more about something that has been reported as having pretty convincing ion lines associated with a high equivalent width.
With a high what?
High equivalent width. ion lines.
A classical gamma ray burst?
Oh, by the way.
Yeah, I think it's that one, yeah. Some meeting in Rome, I think. And so, you know, it does have very...
Was that in the afterglow or in the burst itself?
It must be in the afterglow, you see, the x-rays.
I think I heard, yeah. I heard about the stuff in the afterglow.
I'm not sure I understand the beaming of gamma ray bursts particularly well, but in the radio sources that have been observed by Chandra X-ray Observatory, I think the most tightly collimated jets that have been found in objects like Pictoray and Cygnus A are in the most powerful, seem to be in the most powerful radio sources. So it's the powerful sources that have the most tightly collimated jets that you observe. That's, you know, in the radio sources, that's not the
Yeah, but I can live with that. Mika,
Chris, did you have a
Well, I think it's a fair comment, but I also think you can make jets directly from the disk that are highly collimated.
Yeah, I thought your model was saying that the...
Well, it was a model for gamma ray bursts. It wasn't necessarily a model for all radio jets.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Because clearly you see jets that are not... I'm showing plenty of pictures today of jets that are not coming out of black holes. And
I'm not sure if your model makes sense to me in the following sense, that it seems to me that the spirit of it derives from the idea of interacting winds.
Mm-hmm.
And you have two interacting solar winds, well, they are initially near the source emitting over 4 pi. Mm-hmm. So are you really gaining anything energetically in this type of model? Can you really make it work that right at the position of the central engine, you have some collimation to begin with? Because that's what will allow you to reduce your energetic requirements.
Well, in the case of a dissipative collision, say between two baryonic components, and they at this interface they dissipate everything in I don't know, atomic line photons, then yes,
can you get it wrong?
No, even there there's a big gain, because typically if you just go back to that picture I showed way back of the cartoon of the spherical shell with a cylinder in it, so that cylinder lost the inside fluid lost about half its energy in the dissipative shock. On the other hand, it's infinitely well collimated. It's a perfect cylinder. So to that rare viewer that is looking down the axis, it gained an infinite factor. But here, in the case of baryon pure jets, I don't even think they do that, because we didn't assume they undergo a dissipative shock. We assumed they're reheated, and they just start flowing out like a spherical fireball, a conical section of a spherical fireball. And so they still have, in principle, they still have all their original energy. This could have happened at very high optical depth, and even if you got a shock wave, sure, so the pairs made photons, which then made pairs again, and it's all recycled.
Okay, in that situation, it's not clear to me you can avoid the baryon contamination problem, but...
So I think we should let this continue. Discussion. Let's let people go. Thanks again. Thank you.